Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All is Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So we're starting, all right. And I'm trying to remember my name, and I'm looking in my coat pocket. I've got cards someplace, Diners Club or whatever the hell they are. This, I even have a birth certificate on me. No, I don't. It's a driver's license. But it's clear. On the license, I'm Norman Lear. On his license, it would be clear if I were reading it now, is Paul Hipp.
Hello, Norman.
And Paul Hipp is a glorious actor, writer, singer. Are you still doing The Middle? Is that the show?
Yes, actually, and it's our final season. I got two episodes coming up we're going to shoot, and I think they'll be the last. 9 years, it'll be sad to say goodbye to the character.
9 years. It's amazing how 9 years can go in a weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah.
On the weekend. So we are expecting a guy I spent an evening with a few days ago, or is it a week already? I don't know. But he does a podcast called Love It or Leave It. And he is John Lovett, who's due here any second. He comes in that door out there. I had the best time.
Really?
Have you heard this?
I haven't heard it yet.
Have you ever heard of Love It? Have you heard of his podcast?
I've heard of it. I'm remiss in not.
Well, I got to tell you, I heard of it so much.
Yeah.
Because five daughters, every single one of them has been in touch with me. Some heard it. Several did not hear it, but friends called them about it. And my son, too.
Great.
So I... out of no place, the world.
And he's a young guy, right, John Lovett? He wrote for Obama, he wrote for Hillary.
Yep, he wrote. He's coming in now, the door
is open.
Oh,
here he is.
Out there is the glass window he has to come through. Well, he's not going to come through, he'll come on the other side. Through the door.
Hey, hello.
Come on in, John.
Oh,
John.
I fucked it up.
Well, isn't that what you did the other night, too?
That's true. That's true. That's
so
true.
Is John Lovett, who just, I would never have said those words if they hadn't been said in front of me. I just don't do that.
Anybody don't curse. Yeah. Never curse.
No, never curse. Yeah. I haven't. But John Lovett, you're a wonder.
Well, thank you. That means a lot.
Okay, that's the end of this. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening in.
You know, I really struggle because I'm not good at just taking a compliment. You know, I want to either let it go by. You know, I want to say, oh, stop.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm trying not to do that because that's annoying.
Yeah.
Right? That's annoying.
No, that could be all right. Try it. You give them the compliment. You say, oh, stop.
No, but what you're the. Mystique behind what you're just referring to, but how we continue to do that throughout our lives. I, at my age, which coincidentally, or not coincidentally, is 95 today, as it was since July 27th, this is how I know exactly what you were. I have a picture in my wallet of myself in the service. World War II. I'm 20 years old or something. I look real good. Every time anybody has ever seen it, all of my life, they look at it and say, wow, because I was a good-looking kid. But I follow it by saying, I look like that for 20 minutes in Rome one day. All the time, until 10 months ago or something like that, when I looked at it and I said, because a couple of things have given me this insight. I looked at it and I said, no, why did I just say that? I looked like that at that age.
Yeah.
That was me. Not for 20 minutes in Rome. That was me.
Yeah.
Now, what's startlingly stunning to me is I never had that positive thought until 8 months ago or 7 months ago or something like that. It took me 94 plus years to get to a place where I could look at that picture and admit to myself, yeah, I looked like that.
Huh. I wonder how long it'll take me. I'll try to beat that record.
Beat that record.
I'll try to get it done by 90.
So you should realize now you are young and beautiful.
All right, let's all calm down.
And understand that learning doesn't, even about oneself, where you think you'd know it all, but learning about oneself doesn't stop ever. Hmm. It goes on.
I love that concept.
I love it. It's worth talking about to deliver that message.
Yeah.
That even when you're thinking you know it all about you,
yeah,
you don't. There's always more.
Yeah, that's great news. Keeps it interesting. 95 and still learning every day.
Yeah. Well, I did the same thing the other evening with John Lovett. Love It or Leave It. And how long has that been on?
We've only been doing it. We launched it, I guess, March or April of this year. So we launched a show called Pod Save America, which is a podcast, political podcast I do with John Favreau and Tommy Vitor and Dan Pfeiffer, a bunch of Obama guys. We launched that in January, a few other shows, and then Love It or Leave It we decided to do as a Friday night thing in front of a live audience, and the response has been amazing. It was really an honor to have you there, and people loved it. I mean, it was just such a good time, and you're so funny, and even at the very end of the show, you know, I turned to you and I basically said, help me end this show. And you just took it and ran with it. You just know how to end an episode. It's amazing. Amazing.
Well, about 11 seconds before you did that, the word in the air was rant.
Yes.
And there hadn't been a rant.
We needed the rant.
So I just automatically did a rant.
And it was so funny.
You know.
What was the rant on?
What are you doing here, Paul?
What the hell
are you doing here now? This is what a rant is.
Suddenly
the guy goes off his fucking rocker and is screaming and yelling, and nobody knows what the hell it's about, and it's a rant.
Oh, that's great. That's kind of like the political discourse today.
Yes, he ranted about the show itself to take us out. And it was delightful. It was the perfect close. What a blast.
Awesome.
I'm coming down from the rant now.
You could have a Fox News show like that.
Anyway, it was delicious. But the guy, this John Lovett, sitting opposite us.
Sitting before us, young and beautiful.
was a speechwriter for Hillary.
That's right.
And for President Obama, following that. In between. You didn't write for her in their last run for the presidency?
No. I started with her. So I started with her after college, and I was her speechwriter in her Senate office and then in her 2008 presidential campaign. And then when that ended with a defeat, fool me once, and I ended up, John Favreau, who was going to be Obama's chief speechwriter, reached out to me and said, we're hiring one more speechwriter at the White House. I threw my hat in the ring and ended up working at the White House for President Obama.
How does it happen that a guy gets out of college and gets a gig like that? You must be very good writer.
I was very lucky. So I graduated from college and I didn't know what I was going to do. I gave a speech at my college graduation and I liked performing. So I ended up doing some open mics while I was a temp paralegal. Like I would fill out asbestos forms. You know those law firms that advertise on the train? Well, I was at the losing end. I was at the bleeding edge of that process where people would call and leave messages. And so I would take that information and fill out forms to go down some warren of paralegal, I don't know what. And by night, I would either fill out law school applications to appease my mother or or I would do open mics. And one thing led to another, and a friend of mine said, hey, do you want to come volunteer for a campaign in D.C.? I did that for a few months, and then I end up back in New York. I don't really know what I'm going to do with myself, but eventually I hear from somebody at Hillary Clinton's office saying, we're looking for somebody to help her write some jokes for a roast of Barbara Walters.
A roast of Barbara Walters.
Uh-huh. And they needed some help. And I said, sure, I'd help. I wrote them a few jokes. And I guess that kept them in, it kept me in mind when they were looking for a junior writer. And so I applied to be a junior speechwriter. I'd never really written speeches before, but I sent like college essays. Like that was the level. That's what I was at. I really was not, I didn't have much to show them. I had some press releases I had drafted for these campaigns I had volunteered for in an office I worked for briefly, but they ended up taking a chance on me. And I sort of stuck it out. I basically learned to be a speechwriter while being a speechwriter, which is, I think, what a lot of speechwriters end up having to do. But I stayed with her through the Senate campaign in 2006, through a lot of work in the Senate, then through her presidential campaign in 2008.
Do you remember a Barbara Walters joke?
You know, she didn't end up doing the Barbara Walters roast. So we didn't end up going. But I will remember this. So this was a moment that meant a lot to me, which is I end up – they call me in to come help them write jokes. And I get on the phone and they say, oh, a few people that help us write jokes are going to get on the phone call to sort of brainstorm together. And then all of a sudden the person that gets on is Al Franken. And I loved Al Franken. I loved the books. Like Al Franken was quietly very important to a lot of people exactly my age because of the books he wrote and Air America Radio, which, by the way, is a precursor to a lot of the liberal podcasts.
Not to mention SNL.
Not to mention SNL, of course. But in a political context, he was just beloved by college kids who picked up these books, you know, Lies and The Lying Liars. Right. They're great books. Anyway, I got on the phone and I made Al Franken laugh with a joke about Rick Lazio, Hillary Clinton's 2000 opponent, her bumping into him at a deli in upstate New York making sandwiches. And he laughed, and that was like the coolest thing to me at the time, that I made Al Franken laugh. And then I recounted that story to him, and he did not remember.
When you met him after?
Years later I met him. No idea, no recollection. And then he said it wasn't a very good story, and he was right. But I remember that. That was a moment for me. I was like, you know, that is cool. You know, I'm on a phone call writing jokes with Al Franken.
All of the Above with Norman Lear.
Hi, I'm Allie Hilfiger.
And I'm Steve Hash.
And we're the hosts of Sit-In on Podcast One.
Join us as we travel around the world visiting creative people in their homes, studios, and the places they work to discuss their story, process, and basically everything in between.
We're sitting down with the biggest names in the world of fashion, art, and music, like Tommy Hilfiger, Gigi Hadid, Bryan Adams, Martin Lawrence Ballard, and Zanna Roberts.
Check out new episodes of Sit-In every week, exclusively on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
This is All of the Above with Norman Lear.
But living or working at the White House, how cool was that?
You know, it was an amazing experience. You know, I worked for Hillary Clinton. I thought she was going to be the president in 2008. She loses. I kind of give up on this amazing idea that I sort of lucked into being a presidential speechwriter. And then John reaches out to me, and next thing I know, I'm doing that job. And it was an amazing experience. First of all, I'm getting to know all these people who had been with Obama throughout this incredible campaign. So, you know, you feel a little bit like an outsider, and that's okay. But I had this strange experience where I sort of was doing two kinds of things. I did a lot of these sort of technical, scientific speeches, energy speeches, dry stuff. The financial crisis was going on in the beginning of 2009. And I like policy, and I'm sort of quick with it and quick to write in it. And so I ended up doing a lot of these. There was just a few times where a job statement would come out, and the jobs numbers were terrible at first, right? We were losing, hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of jobs. The economy was on the precipice of another Great Depression. And so the president was constantly going out to the podium to quickly reassure people, talk about the numbers, create some context, as well as rolling out emergency policies around the financial system. And so I ended up working on a lot of that stuff, which was technical and dry and felt very high stakes. And you felt the pressure of doing that. And then on the other hand, the president does the White House correspondence dinners.
Could you talk a little faster?
Am I talking fast?
No, talk a little faster because we need it all the time we could. See, I'm not unhappy I stopped him because I think you should know, you who are listening and are not sitting at this table, that this guy claims to be over 22. But he looks 14 or 12 or something like that. Anyway, this is a very young man.
Well, thank you.
I think I remember you told me he's 31.
I'm 35.
You're 35. I remembered incorrectly.
I turned 35.
But he looks 25. He doesn't look a bit
nice.
Older. And I love listening to you. Good. Go on.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah, continue, please.
So anyway, we're working on the White House Correspondents' Dinner speeches, which are just jokes. So that was sort of the two sides of the work that I was doing at the White House.
Did you write the Trump jokes that are now the reason that the world's being destroyed? We can hold you responsible.
So what you're referring to is in 2011, Barack Obama gave a speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner where shortly after his birth certificate had been discovered, the president made a bunch of jokes at Donald Trump's expense, who was in the room. And Seth Meyers did the same and was just eviscerated Trump. And it has been said that he wanted to prove all these people wrong.
Yeah.
Now, I'd reject that narrative.
Totally. It's so childish.
Because I did help write those jokes.
You did? All right. Put it here. Now you're hedged.
Yeah, sure. So that was the –
Did you write the Biggie Tupac one?
I don't remember which ones – I don't remember exactly. I know that the run about The Apprentice, that was Judd Apatow would call me to help me write jokes. And so he and I would riff on the phone and I'd like sort of take down notes and we'd sort of build up a bunch of jokes together.
Wow.
Because the year before, my social graces, I need help. I'm always insecure in social settings. I never feel like I know the right thing. I get in my head and then I kind of shut down a little bit. Anyway, John and I were waiting to go into the Oval Office to work on the jokes with President Obama. I think David Axelrod was going to join us, maybe some other staffers. I'm not remembering, but we were waiting, which is reasonable. It's the president.
Is John Podesta?
It's John Favreau. Sorry, John Favreau, who is the president's chief speechwriter. And we were waiting, and then all of a sudden, Judd Apatow and his wife Leslie Mann and a few other people are on a tour of the West Wing. And I had met him at something, some event, and he said, "Oh, you know, John, are you here working on the jokes?" And I said, "Yeah, that's what we're doing. Big joke speech coming up." And he goes, "Oh, wow, I'd love to help. I'd love to pitch some jokes." And I said, "Oh, we'd love your help." He goes, "Oh, what are you doing?" "Oh, we're going in to meet the president." He said, "Oh, wow, it'd be great to pitch some jokes to the president." I said, "Okay, nice to see you." And I turned around and I didn't. I felt in the moment, my mind was racing. Like, what's appropriate? Am I supposed to ask him? Is it bad manners to ask and then have to ask somebody else? It's not my place. I'm spinning out, and I panic, and then I just run away from the problem. But anyway, he ends up telling this story about how I cock-blocked him from meeting the president to write jokes. And so from thereafter, I always reached out to him for help. And so we ended up writing these jokes about Trump that, you know, making these tough decisions between who to fire, meatloaf for this rapper. You know, these are the decisions that would keep me up at night. It was great. It was a great night. And we thought we did it. We defeated Donald Trump and we'll never have to hear.
By the way,
again.
Funny jokes.
They were great jokes.
They're great jokes. And the guy, anybody else could have sat there. It's kind of like a roast.
Yes, of course.
It's all in fun.
Yes. And look.
And he has this reaction to it.
I think that what is certainly true is that Donald Trump is a Queens guy who's had a chip on his shoulder his whole life. You know, he reminds me of people in my family from Long Island and Queens and Brooklyn. And he kind of has that. Proving the Manhattan people wrong, proving the kind of upper crust types wrong is part of what's going on for him all the time.
Yeah, like a big silver spoon baby. I'm not going to use that word. I use.
I think that's even more wrong.
Yeah.
This is good, clean airtime. We don't want to waste any talking about that
guy.
Him.
Yeah.
That okay.
Him.
Person. I have only four grandchildren that I adore. I mean, not that I have more and don't adore them. I have four.
Tell us about the ones you don't like.
I have four altogether. And I can't think of people who enjoy great power in our country without thinking about the welfare of those four. And their children, you know, if I want to think further ahead. And just knowing that what's going on right now in terms of leadership is not good for them.
Hmm.
And I'm talking widely. I'm not just talking about the one guy. I'm talking about Republican and Democrat and corporate America and medical America. I don't think what's going on by way of leadership is good for people, for folk, for my grandkids.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually curious what you were thinking. We talked about this a little bit on Love It or Leave It, and you mentioned this airbag problem that went on. You know, I think just today or yesterday it was announced that the head of that company, Equifax, which is a company that just announced that they had accidentally lost or revealed huge amounts of data and information on basically any American with a credit card, that executive who oversaw the company at that time will walk away with $90 million as a severance package. And we got sort of kind of battered by these unfairnesses every single day. Mm. And I do think that these things are connected, that there's something has broken. And I was just curious what you thought about that, like when, if you felt that change yourself, because, you know, you've been an observer of the culture for so long, and that we have seen that there does seem to have been a shift in responsibility. Companies just not being responsible, you know, politicians not being responsible. Like, how do we get that responsibility back?
I'm gonna answer that broadly, only if Paul Hipp will promise to stop me if I have spoken of it the same way before.
I promise. Okay. But sometimes it's a good story is a good story. But I promise.
But so I fought World War II. I flew a bunch of missions for the 15th Air Force out of Foggia, Italy. The war is over. It's hard to explain. I remember I spoke a little Italian, and I remember the morning that Roosevelt died, which was not too much before the end of the war, actually, shortly before. We all were in Foggia. The mission was canceled that day, and 10 o'clock in the morning, a lot of us were already high, drunk. The bars were open early, and I remember standing on the steps of a public building. Maybe there were 30 native Italians in front of me, and I was, you know, talking in Italian to the extent that I could, but they were crying. I would recognize a couple of those faces if I saw them now, and I was weeping. And I was with some other GIs who were also crying. We were all crying because FDR died. And the war ends, and what we were crying about was, yes, great leadership, but out of an in-love feeling for everything American. I'm not questioning people's patriotism today, but wearing a flag pin is not what I'm talking about when we were weeping that morning. And when the war ended and our America developed a Marshall Plan to help Europe get back on its feet, I'm not talking about flag pin patriotism either. I'm talking about being in love with those things that made America, with those promises, as yet fully undelivered, or undelivered fully, promises of equal opportunity, equal justice under the law, all of that stuff that is not all that different from the Sermon on the Mount, or the essence of any one of 100 religions. There was reason to believe, as Americans, you know, we had the capacity for keeping our promises to each other and for building everything we still are intending to build or tell ourselves together. You know, the kind of racial harmony we have yet to establish. But we had civics class. Did you have civics classes?
We had social studies.
Social studies.
Same here. Social studies.
Same as that. They were called civics classes then, but we specifically were learning about those promises that we made to one another about equal opportunity, equal justice, et cetera, under the law. And so I like to think we were in love with America because we were in love with those promises. The Declaration of Independence ends with the founders offering their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And in my lifetime, the only time I think I've seen sacred honor discussed part of a culture was, strangely enough, in the mafia. Mm. You got to go to the mafia where
it's a sacred honor.
Where sacred honor was discussed and it was openly acknowledged. That sacred honor. See, I wandered far from.
No,
where
keep. We, no, we were talking about the change in America to this sort of.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I, following the war, I don't know. It seemed to me we began to believe our own press. We were good, and that was great. The Marshall Plan, my God, how wonderful that we were able to do that. But that didn't make us God's chosen. And we began to believe, and on the far right, there developed more and more of those religious pundits and religious figures, the Falwells, the Robertsons, et cetera, who would have us believe we were God's children.
Hmm.
And that's not good for racial harmony, because they were all white and believed that way. I forget exactly.
So, do you think that manifests in our incursions in other countries during the 60s, in the 50s, 60s, Vietnam? The whole idea of.
I think we live at a time now where too many people believe we're God's chosen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is important there, and I won't. I think it captures something, which is we've sort of seeded a lot of big and important words from our politics. It's a combination of, I think, what you're talking about, which is a lot of these ideas claimed by one political party, that, you know, morality being only the province of one part of the conversation. And then I think there's been a lot of poll testing and words and research and focus groups that have kind of shrunk the acceptable number of phrases you're kind of using in politics, so that political language has gotten smaller, and things like honor and virtue, those are not political words right now, but it should be, right? That's mm-hmm. that's what we're talking about. And I think one, it's not a silver lining. I don't like talking about silver linings, but I think what's going on right now is awakening in people, a reminder that there are civic virtues that are really, really important, that we took for granted, that aren't protected by law, that aren't protected by any regulation, that they're simply born of a shared set of principles that anyone can decide they can discard at any moment if they have power. And figuring out how to reaffirm those, whether it's in a corporate board or in Congress or mm-hmm. in the White House, I think is such a big challenge. And I think it's so important to hear your experience of how that has changed, because there's not enough conversation about that big, deep change.
I don't know whether we discussed this on Love It or Leave It the other night, but I'm sure we have here. The notion, the factoid, American corporations are in the business to I'm an American corporation speaking. I will have a profit statement next quarter larger than this quarter. The following quarter, I will have a profit statement larger than the next quarter. I am committed to a profit statement larger each quarter than the previous quarter. And I am doing that, recognizing there is nothing in nature that suggests anything can grow forever. But I'm in a marketplace that commits me to a profit statement each quarter larger than last, at the risk of being unsuccessful.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, it's incentives that it's an incentive for a CEO to seek short-term gain at the expense of his own employees, at the expense of his own company, at the expense of the larger culture. It's what leads to a lot of these consolidations we've seen, because they're the people.
It leads to the consolidation. That's worth expanding on.
Yeah. So we have this massive. We have, you know, you look, if just in the past decade or maybe decade and a half, we've gone from whatever. Let's say 80% of flights in America. These are not the right numbers, but whatever. There were 7 or 8 big airlines that were most of the flights, and now you have. Continental is gone. Now it's just United, and U.S. Airways is gone, and now it's just American, and Northwest is gone, and now it's just Delta. And so we have these three gigantic airlines, and lo and behold, we don't like the way these giant airlines are treating us. Or we used to have more cable companies, and now there's just these giant companies like Comcast or you know, whatever. There's AT&T and there's Verizon, that we've allowed all this consolidation, and I think one of the It really does change.
And one of the reasons for that consolidation is I'm running a company and I need to be ahead of myself for the next quarter. And I don't have the time to look around and rest and like a good general waiting for when the best move could take place. I have to move quickly because that quarterly profit statement is coming up. So I buy a company.
I grow by acquisition, or you know, I'm the head of this company. You're the head of that company. We'll both make out like bandits if we combine. You see a lot of that, and I think there is a feeling of how all of us being under the yoke of these sort of irresponsible giant entities, it saps people's dignity in their daily life. You don't feel like you have control when you're picking a cell phone or when you're flying or picking a cable company, and that hurts, right? We used to have some say in commerce. You know, it's I think the Democratic Party hasn't had enough answers to this, and the Republican Party has chosen the government more than companies as the boogeyman, right? As the place to point.
But while promoting that very thing and helping it along.
Sure, sure. Well, I think there's a combination of greed and sincere ideological belief that it's not their job to get involved, right? Which is, it's always nice when your greed and your ideology align. It makes things quite simple.
Yeah.
It's funny how that happens.
Right. And who warned us about this?
Eisenhower.
As he was leaving office.
But you said something interesting. We've allowed these things to happen. The people, you know, there's the people. There's these corporations, and we're all being screwed by them. You know, we're all being made miserable on these flights, sitting on top of each other for way too much money and not getting even a bag of peanuts. You know, all this stuff that's going on. Or the cable companies gouging, or all the stuff that's and having no recourse because there's no longer anybody to call. You can't call anyone at the company and have a conversation where they're not reading from a laminated card. At what's the tipping point? Because a lot of voters, it seems, vote against their own best interest where this is concerned.
See,
so what will be the tipping point? What's the end game of all this?
See, I think it's always a mistake to say that somebody's voting against their interest. They told you their interest when they voted. I'm not criticizing you. When I think why are people voting for somebody that's not going to help them, that's going to set them back, but speaks to some grievance or speaks to some cultural problem or some value that they feel is not – some lack of respect. And I think to me the question is, why do people feel so beaten down, so angry, so racially aggrieved that they're willing to put aside all their economic interests to vote for somebody that's going to make them feel better, that's going to give them some brief kind of high of look at who we told to go screw themselves with our vote. I think these things are connected. So figuring out, and I think, again, it's not a silver lining, but it's something we can learn. It's without, you know, there's a lot of racism that goes into what's happening right now. There's a lot of economic problems that go into what's happening right now. What can we do to convince people that there's a better option, that there's a better way, that there's someone with actual answers to these problems, not just inadequate answers on one side and actually harmful answers?
But in other words, convince them to not vote against their own best interest.
Not vote for a demagogue. Not vote for someone who won't tell them the truth. Not vote for someone who
the loudmouth. He'll just say whatever makes them feel good.
I think they voted. I've said it maybe too often on this podcast, but they voted for Trump. He represented the middle finger of the American right hand. I couldn't believe that more as time goes by than I did at that time.
Yeah.
fed up with leadership. You know, yeah. Isn't he the best way to say screw you all?
Yeah. Well, you look up and down these things. Nobody trusts the government. No one trusts Congress. No one trusts the media. No one trusts big businesses. Where's trust right now? Well, it's in a few places. It's in the military. It's in maybe some religious leaders. Right. People are kind of grasping for institutions and places people gather where they still have some sense that they can rely on that institution. It's just not there. And I think it's this catch 22. How do you convince somebody that you're worth trusting when they don't trust anybody? That the thing you need to do to solve some of these problems and rebuild the trust is get people right. to come along. And Barack Obama, I think people thought Barack Obama represented the future in the sense that this is what leadership's going to look like. We're a multi-ethnic society. We're a cosmopolitan society. We're a young culture. We're a college-educated culture. America's changing. But in many ways, what we've seen is that by dint of his talent and unique qualities as in many ways a once-in-a-generation figure, he actually was able to overcome
the fact that he was a black man.
Overcome the fact that he was a black man and overcome a lot of these structural, deeper dark forces we actually weren't paying enough attention to.
Mm-hmm. And also the distrust.
Which are now being let loose. Sorry.
Yes.
No, distrust is the product, though, that a lot of these people are selling, and people are buying it. You know, distrust, manufactured distrust. And then it takes on a life of its own and begins to grow. And I think that's a big part of this problem.
Absolutely. There's cynicism. There's a cynicism is a business.
Yeah.
And it's business is good.
Yeah. So we know who's the Walter Cronkite now? That was correct me if I'm wrong, but he was universally trusted, Walter Cronkite, back in the day.
At a time when it was easier to universally trust. He was universally trusted.
Right.
I think, I don't even remember what difficulty Dan Rather got into, but he's been crawling out of it slowly and wonderfully, I think. And,
yeah.
And
well, there was the Westmoreland thing.
Huh?
The Westmoreland thing was one, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. I say yes to something I couldn't fully discuss. Because I'm not remembering. I just remember there was such an issue.
Yeah,
he had a few controversies over the year. Remember, there was that there was that famous sentence that he said. Someone yelled at him, right? Like,
What's the frequency, Kenneth? Which my favorite. No, my other favorite thing of his is he decided. I think unilaterally, he decided to end the nightly news with a different word, and so he ended the nightly news, and then he said, "Courage." And people are like, what the fuck was that?
We have taken to ending Pod Save America with either good night and good luck or just the occasional courage.
Oh, you Why not? That's great.
Why not bring it back?
Do you do that? Courage.
You do. Courage. I mean, we're laughing, so it's, take it with...
courage. Why don't we end tonight's... We'll end this podcast with all three of us.
Unless
courage.
We think of a better word. If we think of a word that we all agree...
Yeah.
That we like better, like balls.
Yeah.
Balls.
Let's try it.
Let me offer that now.
Yeah, try it.
I'll offer balls. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to think for a minute. Do you have something you would like to...
It's hard to beat balls.
It is hard
as
to
they
beat
say.
Balls.
Did you say meatballs?
Meatballs.
So, are you gay?
I am gay.
I thought I heard you make reference to that.
Well, because I quoted Archie Bunker saying that California nuts are fruity and California fruits are nutty. And I claimed myself to be a nutty California fruit. That was the reference, I suppose.
So can we talk about that?
Sure.
Has this been difficult, this path?
I was very lucky. I think I had a lot of the traditionally hard parts of it. And then I also was very lucky in that my fears were much bigger than the consequences of telling people, right? I think I was born just late enough that it was pretty much a glide path compared to what a lot of other people have had to go through, even now, right? Than from some
right.
less accepting places, even the United States. But it's a subtle thing and it's a strange thing. The closet is a really it's an interesting place to live for a while because you really are alone in there.
How long were you in that closet?
I started telling people right around the end of high school. which was young. Well, I felt proud that I had been able to kind of figure this out, how to do it. And I had a trick, which I have shared with people, which is you have to lash yourself to the mast. So I went to one of my best friends in the world and I said, I have something really important to tell you tomorrow. Because I knew that I would chicken out, that if I sat her down and said, I have to tell you this thing right now, I would just avoid it. Why not avoid it? So I created some pressure on her part to try to drag the information out of me. So she's like, tomorrow, what are you going to tell me tomorrow? I don't want to talk about it right now. But it's very important. It's a big deal. Nothing to worry about, but it's huge news. So I had put myself in a position where I either had to make up some kind of elaborate lie or just tell the truth. And I recommend that for people because sometimes you're ready. You're more ready than you think you are. And in the same way that
that's great.
And I also think.
So how early the next day did she say?
It was pretty early.
Yeah, like, what are you going to tell
it
me?
It was breakfast. It was breakfast. So that was my trick to kind of get myself over the hump to do that. And then, you know.
How far over the hump did you? Never mind. That's a bad joke.
That's my closing word, by the way. Hump.
Yeah. The whole point is I'm not into humps. I avoid humps altogether. Yeah. not my best. Not my best.
So, your folks.
Yeah.
How'd they take it?
They were okay. You know, I think they were surprised. My mother handled it very well. My father took a minute, but he also handled it well. I think he didn't want to. You know, my mother instantly accepted it and was and her reaction was I think the best you can hope for, which is she was sad I had gone through it alone.
That's great.
Yeah, the perfect reaction. Yeah. And my father I think took a minute to accept it. Like he didn't want to believe it for a sec. And I don't think it was and it wasn't there was nothing there was no
there was no we're gonna see a doctor.
No. There was nothing like that. It was more kind of I think he had to work through it. So he wanted to kind of work through. He wanted to argue against it for a second. You know, uh-huh. He wanted to make his case.
Yeah.
And the case is not very good.
You know, make it's like, a case yeah, against you.
Right. It's like, okay, well, can I cross? It's time for cross-examination. Let me tell you some things. Yeah. We can get into it, but I'm pretty sure. I can. So and then I went off to college and I told people. And I think, you know, this was something that I thought – that I didn't even realize till very, very recently. So when I was in high school, Ellen DeGeneres played – remember, she came out of the closet in the show.
On the show, yeah.
In life and in the show. And I think I was – I don't know when that was, but I was something, let's say, 14 at the time. And so nobody knew anything. I barely understood, you know. And it meant so much to me at the time. But I never talked about it. I had this incredibly personal experience with a sitcom – which was Ellen DeGeneres coming out of the closet. And it was riveting, and I think I cried at the time, and I cared about it, and I read all the stories, but I didn't talk about it. And it was only when Ellen DeGeneres got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama, and he told the story – I'll get emotional now – he told the story about what it meant that I sat there, and I was like, holy shit, that was an incredibly important thing, and I've never talked about it. I've never said it out loud. I've never said Ellen coming out of the closet was a big moment in my life. Mm-hmm. I never talked about it with a gay person, a straight person, a friend, nothing. Because I went through that by myself with Ellen.
Right.
And then I'm sitting here watching Ellen DeGeneres get a medal and I'm crying because I'm reliving this thing that I had done by myself. And I think that to me, I think captures something about it, which is big, big, important things that most young people – go through with others, you do by yourself.
Uh-huh.
And that is it's hard. And I think it leaves a mark that you figure out as you get older. Like, oh wait, that's why. And then also little things like, oh, the boys in school, they just figured it out before I did. That's why that happened. Mm-hmm. That's why I didn't get to go there. And also I was kind of a shit to be around, but also.
Well, what's changed? Let's talk about that, Paul.
Yeah, come on. I mean, really.
But for the most part, you know, I being gay is, I like it.
It's, you know, I am utterly amazed at how far, it's hard to talk about it as an issue, but it was such an issue all the years that I was growing up. that it has come so far in relatively so few years.
Hmm. Even since Bush used it as a wedge issue.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that's not that long ago.
So shouldn't we be doing a good deal better on issues such as race, given that we could leap so far? What are the reasons for that?
Yeah. Well, like I said last week, if everybody had a closet black person in their family, maybe we'd come a little further.
But we do. We all do. We're as a members of the human race.
Yeah, well, yeah.
We have the whole race.
That's the funny thing. As people do more of these genetics tests, we're all going to find out that we're all everything, right? As they get cheaper and more people do them, we'll find out that we're all everything. And maybe that'll make the change.
And maybe that will make
the change. It's also, it's part of it is just it's harder to have structural systemic barriers against gay people because we pop up in every family. You know, we pop up everywhere.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, from the richest to the poorest, black, white, everybody, you know, there's going to be a gay kid at the family reunion. And so everybody knows, you know, and so, you know, coming to accept that is something you can see much more easily inside your family. And by the way, you know, just as I think there are people, there are huge parts of this country where it is still very difficult to be a young gay person. And they're still living in a different time, like right now. So, you know, it is amazing how far we came on this issue, but it is true that I kind of move between islands like New York, D.C., Los Angeles, big cities, cosmopolitan college campuses, right? These are places where it's inconceivable. It's almost, it's a shibboleth. It's, if somebody were to say that they were anti-gay, you'd be like, well, we can't. You're disregarded. How could we take you seriously on anything else? It's partly
right.
It is actually inoculated like a generation of young people against the Republican Party because it's just so inconceivable. Like it's mm-hmm. up is down. I'm going to vote for a politician who says up is down. How could I trust anything else you say?
Trust.
Balls.
Is trust your word you're offering?
No, hump. Mine's hump.
Balls is stuck on the other side of this table.
I like balls.
Not
balls
the,
is
not
good.
The first time, Norman.
Balls.
Right. I was looking for a high five. Know what that means.
With that, we shall say balls.
So will you have kids one day?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know. I think so. I think it's important to me to...
Can you have kids? That's
physically?
That's amazing.
I mean, we keep trying. I do want to have kids. I know that I want to build a family, right? I know that. I want the feeling of family.
Yes.
And so I want...
I asked that with that guess in mind, that you're a family person.
Yeah, and I you know, I think one of the things that comes from a little bit of the isolation of being gay is a desire to build your own family. And I think... being gay in the past really meant you had to go to a place and build a family, right? That is, I think, and that's something that really does continue, I think, for gay people. Even at a party, you know, if I go to a party in Los Angeles, all of a sudden I realize it's me and four gay guys and standing around. You know, you find each other, you find your little gay family, and I think you build that. But I want a family, I think, and I think probably I want kids to be a part of that, you know, and I want to build that life. And I you know, I crave those ordinary things. So
I take from that there isn't a current love interest.
There is, Norman.
There is.
There is. Don't even worry about it.
And
is this an exclusive?
How does he feel about kids?
He wants kids too, I think.
The answer is a simple yes. You're going to do that.
Sure. You know.
How long have you been together?
6 years.
Wow.
All right.
That's
marriage.
I mean, I didn't. This isn't Thanksgiving, is it? Am I already at home for Thanksgiving?
Not quite.
You know, Norman, you really, I love talking to you because you're a legend, because you're a fascinating person, because I've looked up to you a long time, but also you remind me of my grandfather.
Oh, yes.
Who fought in World War II. Who grew up in New York, you know, you guys could have been pals.
He passed.
But he was, He worked in the garment district, and sharp and smart,
yeah,
and funny. But
where did he fight in the war?
He was in the Pacific. He didn't fight. Oh. He was at some point. Somebody asked for a volunteer because they needed somebody to type, and he didn't want to volunteer because he didn't want to be the Jew that volunteered to type.
Uh-huh.
So he waited, but they eventually figured out and they grabbed him. I think that's the story. But so he was in the Pacific, and then I think he ended up in Korea for a time. If I've occasionally looked at you a bit agape and sort of with a bit of wonder, it's both because you're Norman Lear, but also because you remind me of my grandfather, Grandpa Dave, David Simon.
David Simon.
I'd have flipped the table. That'd have been amazing.
Oh, my God. It is so amazing to be this age. I'm so glad I forget it so much of the time.
I never think of it when I'm talking to you. It's like talking to somebody's mind. Well, as you say, you're the age of to whomever you're speaking.
There's something that happens when you cross 90. I mean, I never heard a lot about it in my 80s, however late in my 80s. Never heard of it. But crossing 90 suddenly, you know, what's your secret?
Yeah.
You know, here comes a camera. Look at this.
She's moving in on you because she thinks you're about to give the secret. That's why she's coming.
You know what the secret? The secret is that behind the other glass is an engineer who is saying the time we have used was the time we have booked.
Happy balls to you until we meet again.
John Lovett, it's no exaggeration to say I love you. And the way your mind turns and the way your mouth spins, and you are one interesting dude.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And I want to do your thing again in a reasonable amount of time.
Plus, you can also come on Love It or Leave It.
That's
high five. Come on.
Yeah.
And
that's good. That's good writing right there.
So this has been All of the Above with Norman Lear and Paul Hipp. And the last word is going to come from John Lovett, our guest of the day, par excellence.
Courage. Can't beat it.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TheNormanLear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.